Welcome to the Lowride Worldwide Podcast, the first podcast dedicated to global lowriding culture. My name is John Uloa. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Wanted to just take a moment to shout out our sponsors out in Newark, California, RJ Hydraulics. If you have any suspension modification needs, hydraulics, airbags, static drop, whatever you want to do to your car, take it over to RJ and his crew. They're great guys. They've been in the game a long time. They'll take care of you. Follow them on Instagram at RJ Hydraulics. You will not be disappointed. On this episode of the Lowride Worldwide Podcast, we have Ricardo Cortez, artist, historian, digital curator, STEM, art, community workshop facilitator. So much going on with Rick, and we wanted to bring him on and have him tell his story and about what he does and how he does it. So without further ado, here's Rick. All right. Ricardo Cortez, aka Tijuana Rick on Instagram, artist, STEM hero, just, you know, pillar of our community here in the Bay Area. And Rick, thank you for being here. Welcome. And how you doing?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks for the intro. I think you're hyping me up too much, man, but it's all good.
It is all good, man. I thank you for being here, and thanks for doing this. First and foremost, just, you know, give us a quick introduction, a brief biographical sketch of yourself, and tell us, you know, what you do.
Sure. So I'm a San Jose native, born and raised, you know, plan to stay here for the rest of my life. Got my education out here, went to Santa Clara University, went in as a mechanical engineer, but that didn't work out for me. I actually failed out of that program and became an artist instead. And that was the beginning of a beautiful journey for me. I did 10 years working for the city of San Jose, Parks and Rec Department, doing their marketing, social media, kind of community outreach programming over there. Got a master's degree at San Jose State University in digital media. And now I'm a marketing director for a department within Santa Clara University, as well as a part-time or practicing artist. And lowride.
Last but not least, lowride.
Yeah.
Right on. Right on. That's cool. So, you know, so since you ended with lowriding, why don't we pick right back up right on that thread and just, you know, kind of tell us, walk us through how your entry point into lowriding and how that became to be in your experience and your background.
Yeah. So it's a interesting merger of like two different relationships that I had. So my grandfather, all through my childhood, he would come to visit us on Sundays from Concord, Martinez area. And he always drove classic cars. Those were his daily drivers. He didn't really see a reason to buy a new vehicle. So he'd keep those cars on the road. He would see us. And I just fell in love with the cars that he would drive. He had a 54 GMC that he'd bring down and a 67 Buick. And so growing up, I'd always see those cars. Now, when I was in grade school, the school that I went to was, I guess you could call it like a magnet school, where a bunch of different neighborhoods could come together and go to the school. And so, you know, I grew up in West San Jose, but there was kids there from East San Jose, from downtown San Jose. So you get this big mixture of different perspectives and lifestyles, right? And so I think I was 11 or 12, and my buddy Bobby Laguna started to bring lowrider model cars to the school. And I was immediately hooked on them. I was like, what is this? You know, teach me about these. He would make them hop. He would show me how to modify them so that they could hop higher and be more realistic. And not only did it create a beautiful friendship between him and I, we're still friends to this day, you know, 30 plus years later. But that's the initial spark into lowriding. And from there, it just evolved into bikes and eventually inheriting my grandfather's cars and fixing those, teaching myself, you know, mechanics and keeping them on the road and keeping them maintained and just cruising those now. So that's been, I guess, the evolution of my journey into lowriding, and then I have ways that I'm preserving lowrider culture. But that's kind of like a longer extension of my passion for lowriding.
Well, I was just going to ask you, you know, if you could just briefly just touch upon that, like in what ways are you preserving lowrider culture?
Right. So in 2020, during the pandemic, we're kind of all stuck in our houses. And by that point, I had collected a pretty good amount of lowrider print material. So some early issues of Lowrider Magazine, Teen Angel Magazine. But then there was a lot of other obscure magazines that I was able to get a hold of that came out of San Jose, came out of Tucson, Arizona, came out of some other ones from LA as well, like Lowriders Are Happening, and started to scan those magazines and put them online in form of a digital archive that anyone can access. So if you go to lowriderfever.com, you can see the magazines that I've scanned so far. And really it's in the name of open access as a resource for our community to be able to go back and see what were they writing about back in, you know, 77, 76. What did Hot Rod magazines think of lowrider culture when they were featuring lowriders, even before Lowrider Magazine came out? You know, what was this phenomenon of lowriders that was coming out in California? And so not only is it interesting for me to look back from a historical perspective, but it's important for me to be able to preserve this and use my kind of place of privilege to be able to have bought these items, scan them, and then share them back out with everybody.
For sure, because, you know, on the open market, that era, that early era of print media is highly collectible. And as many of us know, and for those who may not know, who might be listening, you know, some of these issues go for thousands, or the asking price is thousands of dollars for a single issue of one of these early issues of this print media. So yeah, it does require some depth of pocket to be able to pony up for them. So I'm hearing a lot about arts. I'm hearing a lot about digital media. So let's jump right into STEM then. You know, just to, if I could just kind of set the story here, you just concluded a very successful program of community outreach and targeting youth to participate in your program. Talk to us about that. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be asked by yourself to participate with the car in the closing festivities. But talk to us about your program and what you did and how it became a program, you know, what you had to do to get it. And let's explore that a little bit.
Yeah. So the city of San Jose, I think this is the fourth year that they do it. They'll put a kind of a call out for artists, and they'll fund programs that they deem community worthy, right? And so in the last round of basically this competition, six artists were selected. I was one of them. And my proposal revolved around teaching kids about lowrider history and engaging them in an art workshop where they can take historical lowrider photos, create collages out of them, and incorporate them into a light box. And then inside that light box, and through the course of the workshop, the students would build a color bar circuit. And by the end of the workshop, which was about 4 hours on a Saturday, you know, the parent and the youth participant would walk out with this functioning color bar that they understand 100% all the pieces that go into building the color bar. They understand the new process of creating collage artwork and turning that into a transparency so it can be illuminated by lights. So I did a series of 10 of those workshops. I think in total, 65 people came through the workshop. And in the early October, we hosted a kind of a wrap-up art show / car show for the community to come check out, this kind of like living exhibit of these lights being illuminated by a DJ. And it was just a really immersive and interactive event. And a shout out to you for coming down all the way down to show off your Rivi, man. I think that was a showstopper. It was definitely a showcase piece within kind of the setup that we had in that warehouse.
It was a fun time. It was a great night, and the vibe was fantastic. And it was definitely a family atmosphere. It was a lot of fun to do. Right. So again, thanks for having me. But for those who may not have any idea what a color bar is, why don't you just walk us through what a color bar is and what a color bar does?
Right. So color bars are a custom car accessory. They became very popular in the late 1960s. And essentially what it is it's a thin metal box that has a clear lens on the front of it, or somewhat of an opaque lens with a design on it. And there's light bulbs inside of this box, and those, through circuitry, it's wired to your speaker system. So when you turn on your radio or you turn on your stereo, the light bulbs will react to the different frequencies of sound. And so it actually turns your car into this like living, breathing, interactive type of environment through the incorporation of these color bars. And, you know, there's a really interesting history of the invention of the color bar. You know, people have been interested in combining lights and sound since the early 1700s, where the very first, you know, iteration of a color bar, if you will, was invented. And there's been different, you know, variations of that until the modern day ones, which we have today. But I think they're really cool. Not everybody uses them, but I love the concept behind them. It's actually the first accessory that I bought for my lowrider was a color bar.
So simply put, you get this box that has lights in it. You wire it to the speakers, turn on the stereo, and the lights move to the rhythmic pulsation of the music, the frequencies, if you will.
Yes. Right? Yep.
And we've talked about this in previous conversations that, you know, back in the day, the 60s and 70s, the jukeboxes that would also, you know, the lights on the faces of the jukebox would dance, right. or you know, it, back in the 70s, the old disco dance floors that would react to movement. That's the same technology.
Yeah, I think at a fundamental sense, it is it's pretty much exactly the same thing, right? There's sound that comes in as an input, the circuit does its thing, and the output is the intensity of the light in conjunction or in sync with the music. I think it's like the most perfect STEM project that somebody could build, to be honest, right? Because at the end of the day, you're creating something that's living, right? That it reacts how it needs to react based off the circuitry that you're putting together. And so being able to teach that and walk people through that and have them understand not only how to build it, but the history tied to car culture, or especially custom car culture, is it's pretty gratifying to see when folks kind of, when it clicks for them, right?
So your program ran for a duration of what, 6 months thereabouts?
Right, yeah. So we kicked off end of May and wrapped up early October. So that was really the kind of like the active classroom part. Leading up to May, I was doing a lot of marketing and promotion and kind of just getting the word out, putting little facts out there about San Jose history, lowrider history, color bar history. And then after October 8th, you know, it was just a bunch of wrap up videos kind of showing in a celebratory fashion, like this is what the kids created, right? This is who came through the program. This is how far they traveled to come to this program. I had someone come all the way from Reno to participate in this really unique program. So it was pretty cool.
Wow. So walk us through one of the class sessions. So, so a child and parent or guardian show up on a Saturday. What happens?
Right. So they'll come into this classroom, or this office space that Google actually gave to me, for the duration of these courses. They saw, or a representative of theirs, shout out to Ricardo Benavides out there, just listening. He saw that I was awarded this grant program, and he's like, hey, I have an office space that's not going to be used on Saturdays. So in the heart of downtown, right across the street from the SAP Center, folks will arrive at about 10 o'clock. I have snacks out there for them. The seats are set up kind of like in a horseshoe shape, and there's a really nice presentation screen at the front of the classroom. And you know, as soon as everyone arrives, you get into somewhat of a lecture about lowrider history, about color bar history, about the history of collaging, you know, and its relevancy to, you know, protest and activism from the 1920s. And so kind of putting the audience into the context that they're creating something that has a 100-year history, right? Collaging was popular in the 1920s. We're still creating them in 2022. Then we'll break for lunch. Everyone gets a free lunch, a burrito from Iguanas. And then we'll jump into the color bar circuit building where, you know, they'll be collaging their photographs together, and they'll be building and walk through their circuit, assemble all of that and kind of do all the hands-on part for about an hour. And at the end of it, they're done and they get to walk away, and it's kind of all packaged for them to walk out, go home successfully with a pretty cool art piece that they can talk about to their friends and family.
That's amazing. I mean, there was so much described in that minute. The things that are jumping out to me is the intersection of history, art, STEM, community building, family building, you know, people sharing a meal together. That is certainly, you know, bonding community and strengthening, you know, bonds on so many different levels. I mean, so, you know, what's amazing to me about what you're describing is the depth, all of the different layers of how much that this program is really accomplishing is really overwhelming when you start to break it down like that. So, you know, what I'm wondering about is, like, for example, like during lunch, what are people talking about? Because you have a room full of, you know, youth with guardians, you know, mixed gender. Talk to us about, you know, perhaps cross-cultural. What were some of those conversations like?
Yeah, so that was, you know, everything you just said, I hadn't even planned any of that, right? It just felt like an efficient structure to implement when I was doing these programs. It just made sense to me. But what resulted out of that were these beautiful relationships that would start to develop in just within these 4 hours. And they're probably not talking to each other after the fact, but while they're in the class and while we're eating, it's like, we're all friends, right? We're all just talking about these kids that are in there and they're, you know, 12, 13, 14. And I'm asking them, you know, what their interests are. What are you thinking about for possibly college or going into a career path? And a lot of them are like, oh yeah, I like, you know, engineering, or I really like video games or putting things together. And, you know, this is kind of cool that we're doing this. And, you know, people are sharing stories of either kind of their lives, whether it has to do with low riding or not. People are sharing resources. Like, there was this one guy that came in from Pleasanton, and he was telling us how he's able to teach his kids for free how to fly an airplane. And they're getting their aviation license, you know, at 14 years old, and eventually when they're legal, they'll be able to fly their own plane, but they're getting training now. And, you know, some other parents are there and they're like, oh, what, they, you know, they want to take advantage of that. So it was really interesting how the conversation started to develop and flourish, just in a matter of, you know, 45 minutes of having lunch.
So in this case, sky's the limit is not a cliche. Right.
Yeah, seriously, man.
I mean, you know, I mean, and people that woke up that day probably never in their wildest imagination thought that their kid flying a plane was within the scope of possibility on that given day. But then it becomes possible, you know.
Yeah, totally.
I think it's an amazing testament as to what happens when you just get people together. You know what I mean? I mean, historically, human beings come together in times of tragedy and hardship, mm-hmm. in times of war or great catastrophe. And here's an opportunity for people to come together who would not necessarily normally come together on a Saturday afternoon. And they're coming in the spirit of trying to learn something, you know, be it history, STEM, art, all of the above. And then this amazing thing happens where you're sharing a meal. And I think that that's such an undervalued activity in our culture anyway, you know, especially in our fast food, rapid 30-minute lunch, woof it down while you're checking your email or what have you. I think it's, you know, there's something to be said for people to just hit the brakes, sit down together. And I mean, like, sit down, engage, focus, have good conversation, because you never know what can happen that can come out of a context like that. It's really amazing, man.
Yeah. And what was really cool is, like, you got these homeboys coming in, right? They want to take advantage of this program because it has to do with lowrider culture. They're lowriders. Their kids might be expressing interest into lowriding, and this is a way for them to bond with their child over, you know, art making, right? And hopefully a shared interest. But then you have people in there who know nothing about lowrider culture that are attending the program simply because they see the educational value of learning electronics and circuits and, you know, possibly collage making, right? But then you put them in a room together and it's like all of the barriers are gone, like they drop, right? Where normally these folks probably would never kind of cross paths, you know, maybe they might avoid each other, who knows, right? But when we're sitting there and we're eating together and we're creating together and we're laughing and we're having conversations, it's like all of those, you know, perceived fears are gone, right? Those barriers are broken. And it was so cool to see this, like, cross-cultural, you know, cross-pollination, if you will, kind of happen in real time.
And intergenerationally as well, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, from my recollection, correct me if I'm wrong, you set age parameters for this thing, right?
I did. Yeah. So the reason for that is that I feel that, you know, 12 to 17 is a very dynamic age for folks to really start to understand not only their own identity, but what they might be interested in. But I was a part of a program very similar to the way that I structured this class when I was their age, right? When I was 12, 13, 14, it was at San Jose State. It was called MESA, Mathematics, Engineering, Science, Achievement. And it was a Saturday workshop, which really inspired the way that I built this workshop, right? It was like STEM before they even called it STEM in the 90s. And so that was the age range that I targeted, although I did make exceptions. And, you know, there was kids that were in there about, I think the youngest was maybe like 6 or 7 years old, and they were able to complete the project too. They had a little bit more guidance, but they understood all of the concepts then. And they were really, really, really good at the collage part, right? Cutting out images, gluing them together. So it was kind of interesting to see how the different ages would tackle the project, right? And everyone was successful, which was cool.
And for those of you who don't know, STEM is an acronym for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. So it's right. It's shorthand for the sciences, if you will, as a generic umbrella. So Rick, then, were the guardians able to participate as well, or were they simply overseeing the activity of their youth participant?
So originally it was supposed to be where the parents would help the youth participant along the project, right? And they could bounce ideas off of each other. But when it came time for the class to actually happen, there was definitely some no-shows. People that would flake out or something that would come up and they would let me know. And so for the most part, there was enough material, and I would always bring extra kits too. And so there was enough material for the child to be able to produce their artwork and the adult to be able to jump in. And I even had requests, you know, even before the class started, be like, hey, I'm going to be there on Saturday, but I want to make my own color bar. And I was like, yeah, cool. I'll bring an extra kit just in case, you know, and everybody that wanted to build something was able to build something. And it was just really cool to see, like, an older individual, you know, get down with glue sticks and you know, pasting things together. But, you know, the way that they would gravitate towards certain imagery kind of just showed their relationship to low writing, or if they weren't into low writing, they would just show their relationship to visual aesthetics, right? That's what they would end up cutting out.
I would love to talk to every adult participant, have like a focus group, and ask them about their own educational experience in school, right? Them as a student. Mm. And then ask them, how their educational experience would have been transformed if they had something like this when they were in school to hear their answers. I would, in a hypothetical parallel universe, I would love to know what that would be. Cause I think that, because as an educator and as somebody who's working on pedagogy and who's trying to develop new ways of connecting with marginalized or underrepresented groups, that's the stuff that I'm trying. In other words, it's like, okay, you know, what can we learn from the past and how can we change it right now in real time so that people don't fall through the cracks? You know, I'm imagining a homeboy in a Pendleton, probably some creased down 501s, if I could be totally stereotypical for a moment, you know, and you pick the footwear, but, you know, I'm thinking about that person, in your words, getting down with glue sticks and scissors and X-Acto knives, right? In other words, like totally engaging in an artistic activity in the moment and how that would bring out one's inner child, right? Mm-hmm. And the fun of doing something, you know, that tactile and that focused, that most importantly is a reflection of that person's own cultural background, history, identity that they can relate to. You know what I mean? It completely changes for the better. It makes the teaching and learning and that pedagogical experience, that activity, if you will, just it's pure gold. It has meaning at that point, as opposed to, oh man, here I am gluing something together that I have that's not even related, you know?
Right. Yeah. And to be honest, there was one individual that really sticks in my head right now who was just like that, right? Came in with the lowrider hat, had the flannel, you know, short sleeve flannel on. He had like the huaraches with the high socks, and he was getting down, and the imagery that he was selecting was unique to his perspective of lowriding and the culture and growing up in East San Jose, right? And when he walked out of there, he was like, man, he's like, this really brings me back to when I was a kid, because I would get the old magazines and I would cut them out and I would glue them to my wall or glue them to like a board or something like that. Just the images that I liked. He's like, this is like a total throwback. And he's like, I love this stuff. And I'm able to be here with my son and we can create our own thing. And I was like, man, that was pretty heavy when he told me all that. I was like, that's exactly what I was envisioning would happen, you know?
Man, that's amazing. I mean, it's just, I wasn't there, but I can envision that, you know, and, you know, for 6 months, people made lifetimes full of memories, you know, and that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, I hope so, man. I hope people remember coming to this course. And if one kid, you know, I think I told you this before, but if one kid comes out of this course 10 years later and is just like, damn, that lowrider art class changed my life, right? Or changed my perspective on what my career could be or my career path or how I can involve my culture into my work, right? Into my profession, man, that would be it for me. If it was just one kid that came out like that, I would be really happy.
No doubt. I'm thinking about you and you as your young self and your friend at the kitchen table building models, and you know, you talking about that exposure, your grandfather's influence and those being your entry points into low riding, and how many kids your course was their entry point into low riding. You know, because there's no neutrality in low riding. There's not. You either love it or you don't. You know, I mean, there's no lukewarm area with it. You know, it causes that reaction in people. You know, and I've seen it on both sides. You know, people who are totally love it. You know, or you like they look at the car and you know they have that look of horror on their face, like, he ruined that perfectly good American automobile. Right. I mean, it's yeah. Because there's no neutrality with it, you know, mm-hmm. You know, And I just, you know, that love that you felt, you know, and the exposure that these kids have had on another level, not that they maybe weren't exposed before, especially the ones with family ties, you know, to it, or they literally are growing up in it. But, you know, now, you know, they're being taught the history, they're being, you know, engaging with it in an artistic capacity, you know, and then you add the STEM component, you know, to really solidify the whole experience. That's powerful. That is certainly powerful. And, you know, I think that, you know, this is going to bear fruit at some point on some level, some way, you know, I mean, there's just no walking away from it any other way.
Yeah. And I think that art is probably the most accessible way to get into low riding, right? As a young kid, you know what I mean? Like, even before I was getting into model cars cost money, right? You have to either have money from an allowance, or you got to have your parents buy you a model car and understand how to, you know, buy all the supplies that go along with it, glue, the right glues, the right paint to be able to do a model car, and it can add up. But collaging, taking images from the internet and printing them out, I mean, that costs pennies to be able to do that, right? And then you can take it from there and do your thing. And everyone can be an artist, right? Everyone has the skills to be able to create something out of nothing. So for me, and I said this during that Lowrider Symposium or the Lowrider Conference, is that I think art is the easiest and most accessible way for anyone to get into lowriding, right? You can become a lowrider artist and then take it from there.
And that's what I love about the program, because when you think about art, you don't necessarily, one doesn't necessarily associate art with STEM, right? And you're bringing them both together and just doing something super cool, you know, on, you know, I mean, it's just, it's really mind blowing, you know, when I think about how much of an impact this had on the community. And, you know, that love was reciprocated right back to you at the closing, you know, and, right. And I think that was really a wonderful thing to see the community come out and support you in your closing event, because that speaks volumes to, you know, how you're valued. I don't think that people were just quote unquote there for the show and shine. People were there to support.
Definitely. No. Yeah. 100%. I mean, everyone that showed up when I messaged them, cause I invited the folks to come in and park within the gates of that property, right? Because the parking lot was so small, I didn't have a lot of room and I overpack it. So everyone that I hit up was like 100%, I'll be there, right? Like I'll show up, I'll help out, you know, just let me know what you need. And then from there, like the street just, and the parking lot across the street just filled up because people either heard about it going on, or they saw the advertisements for it and they just came out to support. And that was pretty, you know, moving for me, right? Cause it validated what I was doing, right? There was a bunch of kids out there. We had a video game developer out there showing off his lowrider hopping game, you know, and it was just, it was a really cool experience to be able to see that closing. But to go back to STEM real quick, from day one, I had marketed and proposed that this was actually a STEAM event, right? So art incorporated in there after engineering. And I called it STEAM con estilo, right? So we're giving the STEAM education a lowrider twist, right? So we're giving it some estilo, because STEAM is it's the careers of the future, man. You know what I mean? Like all these kids that are in high school and middle school right now, that's where the career paths are going to hopefully take them, right? Yeah. That's where most of the market is going to go. So to be able to introduce them through lowriding, I think it's really different. I wish I had that when I was little, but I'm just happy to have been able to be the conduit for that for this past year.
It's amazing because, you know, to say that, my son had an extra credit assignment the other night that was due, and the instructions were very explicit. Print out your photos from your Thanksgiving break, cut them out, glue them to a white piece of paper, put your name on it, and turn it in for a maximum of 5 points. That was his assignment. Mom, text me the pictures real quick. He's 12. Mom, text me the pictures real quick. He dumps them into his app. He lays them out in the way he wanted them. He put his text over it, right? I mean, it's digital media.
Right.
You know, and we're like, son, you're totally overcomplicating what you're supposed to be doing. No, I want to do it my way and blah, 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 blah. And I was saying, yeah, that's what he's interested in. You know, it's digital media. So I completely agree with you. I mean, the development of the technology is happening at such a rapid pace, you know, and, you know, it just, you know, I remember like when PowerPoint came out, it was like, wow, PowerPoint is so cool, you know, and now, you know, given the other options that we have, if nothing else to enhance a PowerPoint presentation, right? I mean, it's just, you know, literally it's endless and limitless opportunities to create and not only create, but create stuff that's really, really cool. And, you're right in there and that underscores like the relevancy of what you're doing to reach young people. And that is even more impactful than this just being a workshop, you know. Big props for you, like methodically approaching this and really figuring out how you're going to do this to really, really engage kids in the community, man. I can't say enough about it.
I appreciate it, man. I mean, you know, going back to that PowerPoint example, it's like, okay, here's PowerPoint. Here is who I can learn from. But what if I was able to learn from somebody who was cool, right? Like they're able to really hack this thing and tweak this thing and maximize the potential of this thing, right? So for me, taking STEAM education, it's like, yeah, it's in schools already. You know, there's websites dedicated to STEAM projects. But what if you were to learn STEAM from someone who looks like you, right? And is in the culture that you're in, right? And be able to remix the ideas and the perspective of STEAM in a way that aligns with your lowrider passions or your artistic passions, right? That I think is what's missing, right? Is being able to learn from people that look like you. And so the more that we can do that, I think the more that we're gonna be able to inspire our youth, right? To be able to aspire to better jobs, to more creative jobs, to more creative fields, to more powerful positions.
You know, and I think that is really an important point because I mean, that's in education. I mean, we talk about that quite a lot, right? Like, you know, success and retention, right? You know, mm-hmm. who's completing classes, who's staying in and who's having success, you know, as far as, you know, passing classes. In other words, what's the magnet that holds a student in a class for the duration of that class? You know, representation is super important, right? Taking the class from somebody that looks like you, number one, yeah. Somebody that has your same background, you know, somebody that speaks the same language, mm-hmm. somebody who is not going to look down upon you or ostracize you or shut you out because you don't quote unquote speak properly or you're not speaking, you know, standard American English. You know, I mean, all of those things count in terms of, you know, not only culturally relevant pedagogy, but also culturally responsive and ultimately culturally sustaining mm-hmm. pedagogy, you know, planting those seeds with deep roots that are going to last over the long haul, you know, and those are all really important ideas that you're bringing into this thing.
Yeah, man, I really appreciate that. You kind of saying that right now, it kind of gave me the chills, man, because when I was younger, I didn't see any of that, right? I was learning from my peers about lowriding. I had to teach myself about lowrider culture, right? I wasn't born into the lifestyle. So a lot of the learning was on my own, but had I had someone that could guide me, that was, you know, that looked like me, that knew the ropes, that, you know, I don't know where I would be at right now, but, you know, the fact that I was in a position to be able to do that and do something good and positive for my community and for the lowrider culture, right? Because we're always dealing with the negative stereotypes of what lowriding is, but to be able to kind of teach about the beautiful and rich history that we have, especially in San Jose, to people who grew up in the lifestyle and some people who had no idea what low riding was all about, right? And kind of sharing all that with each other is, it was a pretty incredible experience.
So having some time to have reflected on your proposal, successful execution of this program, and now you've had a little bit of time, couple months to consider what you did and how you did it. What are, you know, a couple of like major takeaways for you in retrospect?
I think that the main hurdle that I had the entire time was getting people to show up. So I had 100 seats available over the course of the 6 months, and I used Eventbrite to collect registrations, and that filled up probably by, you know, a couple months in. Once I opened registrations, all the seats were full. But when it came time for the class to happen, I don't think there was only one class that I had 100% capacity, you know, show up. The rest of them, either they flaked out or they just, you know, completely ignored my emails and, you know, and follow-ups and whatnot. So that's the only thing that I'm still trying to figure out, you know, how do I get 100% of people to show up for a program like this? But other than that, I think the program ran pretty smoothly. Just kind of looking at, I don't know that I could have done anything better. I mean, I wish I could have more time with these folks and do a bigger project. But I think for the time that I had in order to keep people's attention and engage with them for, you know, 4 hours and not have them get bored and not fall asleep, I think that went pretty good.
Right on. How did this change you personally? What did you learn? Talk about your personal growth in all of this.
Well, I know that I went in with a crazy idea that I didn't know it was going to be successful. And I came out definitely with some more confidence in the fact that if I put a program together, number one, I know that I can do it. But number two is that I know that people now will see me as a credible source to say, hey, I want to go show up for this course or show up for this program or show up for this workshop or lecture or panel or whatever it is. Because since the program wrapped, even in the middle of the program, people were recognizing the fact of what I was doing for the culture and the community, right? So the programs were 100% free. I didn't charge people anything. They tried to give me money at the end of the course. I was like, no, like that's not what it's about, right? It's about you showing up and being able to engage with everybody in this class. And so because of that, people were inviting me into speaking engagements. I was able to speak at the no cruising repeal, you know, celebration in front of like 500 people. I was able to give a speech. I've been to classrooms. I was able to go to an elementary school and teach about lowrider history during, you know, September 16th. Been on, you know, a bunch of interviews, both in print and TV. And so for my personal growth and exposure, this program, you know, and it's all attributed really to the city of San Jose for having faith in me to be able to launch this, has grown quite a bit. And so I'm really grateful for that.
That's amazing, man. You know, and, you know, I mean, what bigger name than Google, really? And, you know, for Google to also support you in this is a super huge thing. You know, I just, really, man, I get overwhelmed because there's so much going on with what you're doing and with this. You know, you and I go back, what, I think it's like 3 going on 4 years now with you building the Low Ride Worldwide box for me, and then, you know, doing the custom color bar for the Riviera, and being a consultant on a lot of my build and the technical aspects of it. You know, you're getting so much done, really emerging as a pillar in the community, whether you want the title or not, it's happening. You know, and, you know, you're doing such amazing work in the community, man. And I just wanted to extend a thank you from the bottom of my heart, because, you know, we need our community, communities, plural, you know, whether they low ride or not, need more positive role models. And certainly we need STEM leaders, and we need, you know, more representation in STEM. I know your focus is more in art, but we need that, and you're bringing that. And, you know, who knows? I mean, who knows how many of those kids might go on to become engineering majors? You know, I mean, you don't know, man. We're planting seeds. And when it comes to youth, you know, those minds are like sponges, man. So keep planting those seeds, keep doing what you're doing. I appreciate you doing this interview with me, and thanks for being here. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, man. Thanks. Just if I could quickly say, you know, I didn't, I'm not involved in STEM. Like I didn't go to school for STEM. I've failed out of engineering, right? Went to the arts, but I taught myself a lot, right? When it came to circuit building and coding and programming and kind of just picking people's brains and asking questions, right? And then kind of evolved into this really unique program because I was able to combine my passions. So, you know, for any listener out there, it's not that you have to be completely 100% immersed in anything STEM related, but low riding is all STEM, man. You know, it's all engineering. It's all art, you know, especially when it comes to painting cars. It's math on understanding hydraulic pressures, right? And so on the website that I put out there, when people were getting registrations, I kind of broke down why low riding is a perfect example of a, you know, a STEAM project, right? And great for STEAM education, man. So just want to thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate it. Appreciate our friendship, and, you know, we'll keep it moving forward, man. Thank you.
Right on. Thanks for being here, Rick, and all the, you know, wonderful wishes and blessings and success to you and your family. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Have a good one.
That was a great conversation with Rick. He's doing so much amazing work, as you've just heard. Amazing person, giving heart, and really creating change. You know, when we think that we may not have it in us, or, oh, I can't make a difference, or, oh, what difference is it going to make? You never know. The seeds that we plant today bear fruit tomorrow. We may not see it right away, but eventually it will. We never know how we might be influencing or inspiring people to do great things. And Rick is certainly doing that for the community on so many levels. Happy holidays to all of you. May 2023 bring you everything that you want and need, and all the best. Thank you for your continued support, and happy holidays to everybody. Thank you.